Coming up, Phil Rosenthal joins Ileana in just a minute.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
And now, it's the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast, starring Ileana Douglas. Eavesdrop with Ileana as she interviews Hollywood's most prominent players about filmmaking, acting, and what really happens on the set of your favorite flicks and TV shows.
Hello, everyone. It's Ileana Douglas. Hi, welcome to the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast. I'm here with my lovely co-host, Tamara Berg.
Hi, everybody.
Nobody notices you're wearing the same thing. No,
thanks.
I'm kidding you. Well, we had, because we, just to give people the inside, we often shoot two shows sometimes. One time we did three shows.
We did do three one day. That was a heck of a day.
Oh, my God. That was amazing. That was fun.
I am always exhausted after this. Are you?
Or yes.
Are you? Yeah. I'm spent. I practically fall asleep in the car on the way home.
I go home. I'm always surprised. I'm like, all I did was talk. But and mainly about myself, if I can't know. I'm kidding. I'm exhausted.
Yeah.
Talking and all that stuff.
Well, I think some of it is the excitement of the guests that we have. I mean, because, you know, we've been so lucky. You've done such a great job of pulling in hi, nice to meet you. Will you be on my podcast?
I know.
Well, it's been incredible, though.
Well, plus we're really excited because I'm still laughing about Rich Little and
the
gag about how Cary Grant, movie star, sneezing. Please. I'm stealing that bit immediately.
So funny.
But anyway, which will be an upcoming show, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Or recently past show, depending on when.
Yes, we don't know.
When we release them.
Today it's going to be really interesting because we're talking to Phil Rosenthal, who is a friend.
I was going to ask you, how do you know him?
Well, we met and we're going to talk about this.
He's
a person I met at various parties. I quizzed him outside, so we're gonna save it for
remembers. Absolutely.
I'm sometimes cursed with like a really good memory.
You have an amazing memory. I'm like quite an envy of yours.
Do you think would I be able to say photographic? I'm beginning to think maybe it's photographic.
Well,
I remember a lot.
You have an encyclopedic memory. That's what
maybe.
I usually say to people because I don't know how you experience it, but watching you and listening to you, sometimes there's just a tiny bit of a lag. Most of the time, it's right there in front of you.
Yeah, sometimes, you know.
Every once in a while when you have to dig really far into the archives, but almost all the time, it's just like, here it is.
Or it'll eventually come back to me. I hope that it never goes away.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Keep using it. Keep using it. That's what they say.
I'll keep using it. But one of the things I was going to talk to Phil about, I'm going to ask him, is this idea of, you know, are you born funny? Can you teach someone to be funny? Do you remember like the first joke you ever did or first thing? Like when I was little, I was telling jokes.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I would write, I'd do little cartoons and make jokes. My mother was always astonished. Like, you know, it wasn't like anybody told me to be funny, but I always had this sort of ability to try to make people laugh.
Do you remember the first time you made people laugh? Or an early memory of making people laugh?
It was probably, it was a cartoon. I did this little cartoon, and it was sort of clever, of a kid hiding behind a very thin tree. And thinking, oh, see, you laughed. I can't believe you laughed. Well, my mother, she thought that was like real. She was like, how does a kid come up with a concept like that? That's so. And it was very, you know, sort of crude, but that was the idea. And when I look at it now, I'm like, it's actually pretty funny. I don't know how I came up with that, but like a very large kid thinking he's hiding behind a very thin tree.
Mm.
So
I remember actually trying to figure out the difference between people laughing at me
versus people
laughing at, you know, things I was doing. Because I was and still am, a very sensitive soul.
Right.
And so, you know, people making fun of me versus, you know, laughing at something I created was, there was a little bit of a watery time there where I couldn't figure out, you know, my way because I didn't want people laughing at me, but I did want to make them laugh.
Yeah.
You know? And yeah, I think there is probably it's some sort of maturity, some sort of like self-awareness that maybe you get a little later in life.
People were always my first laughing at me experience. My parents used to play charades a lot, and somehow my older brother convinced me to be wait for it, Lady Godiva.
Oh.
And he was the horse.
Oh.
And this seemed like a really, really, I was 35. No, I was, no, I was very, I mean, I think I was about four or something. Like, okay. I was really young.
Yeah.
But anyway, my brother convinced me, and I don't think he did it to trick me. I think he thought it was like, oh, this brilliant. Is going to be genius. Mm-hmm. And I put long toilet paper in my hair that was supposed to be my long flow.
Yeah, wow, that, you had props in charades.
Yeah, that was supposed to be the hair. And I guess what must have been so funny about it was, again, like just I went in, you know, Stefan went into the room, you know, and I was on him on the horse. I guess I figured everyone would understand this concept and not just see a little naked girl riding on top of her brother. Yeah, with toilet paper in front of a room with like 30 drunken
adults.
70s, you know, hipsters. And people literally started screaming, like screaming with laughter that I've never, I mean, again, this image that I have, my mother literally like couldn't get control of herself, like people falling off of the, it's like something you'd see in a flashback in a film, you know, and of course I stood up in horror and ran out of the room, ran out of the room and stuff like that. And then subsequently after that, I remember, of course, just, you know, I remember doing scenes, as I've said, in acting school where it was supposed to be really serious.
Oh, yeah.
And people would just laugh, and I didn't really understand why.
Is that when you started to embrace your comedic?
Well, my friend Dave Merkin says, just to give you an example, and then we're going to, because I want to talk to Phil Rosenthal about this. He says, I say the word funny. See, he just laughed. It worked. I said,
I'm a big fan of your friend, Dave Merkin.
We love Dave Merkin.
To agree with it. We should have him back on the show.
Oh, I love Dave Merkin. He's one of the, he's like my go-to person. As I've always said, you need someone in your life. If you are at a party and Dave Merkin is there, he'll talk to you.
He'll support you.
He'll support you and be your friend.
Yes.
But he always says, I'm funny. And he loves the way I say funny.
Okay.
And Jerry Lewis used to say, I love the way you say yes. You know, that was his. Because I said, you know, it's a combination of yeah and yes. I was like, yeah, yes.
Yeah, you can't do it when you're trying.
Yes.
But
yes. And funny.
Funny.
I'm funny.
You're funny. You are funny.
I don't know what's going on.
You
just
even
keep
say funny,
it.
Funny.
So oftentimes.
John's laughing.
Oftentimes, I would be trying to do something very serious. As I once said, the movie I did with Richard Dreyfuss.
Oh, yes.
Meyer Lansky.
Yes.
I'm crying and doing this very serious scene. And the director, John McNaughton, said, you sound like Barbra Streisand. I was trying to be really serious in the thing. I'm going to make a terrific pot roast. Maya, come in. Stop killing people, Maya. And that's what I sounded like. And I was trying to be, you know, so.
Maybe you should have gotten some tips from Rich Little on that accent.
I'm going to be high on the Rich Little thing. Just Rich Little in the green room. Before the roast. I will carry that image with me forever and ever. Okay, let's bring in someone who's really funny. He's paid to be funny and have people laugh at him. Wonderful Phil Rosenthal is an Emmy and a WGA award-winning writer and a producer known, of course, for Everybody Loves Raymond and Coach. He's also an actor. He's appeared in the Simpsons movie, 30 Rock, Better Things. Spanglish. Where's the Spanglish credit? I love that picture of you up there. And your Netflix series, Somebody Feed Phil, which we love, makes me really hungry. Please welcome Phil Rosenthal. Dun, 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 dun.
I'm very happy to see you.
I'm very happy to see you, too. Our opening topic, I will get to your first film that you saw. But we were talking about the idea of like, you know, the scene in My Favorite Year. Are you funny? Or can you teach someone to be funny? Can Mark Lynn Baker teach someone to be funny?
You can help.
You can.
Now, it's like punching up a script. You can. We always said you could raise it maybe one or two letter grades, but you can't make an F and A.
Isn't there something about Is there a snobism with being funny eventually?
I think there is. I think when, like, there are people who are cool.
Yeah.
And, like, I remember I interviewed to get the job on Raymond. I had to go to New York and sit with David Letterman to get the job. It was his
production company.
And so I had to go there at the height of Letterman-ness.
Right.
And, you know, I was a fan. I watched him all through college like everybody. Yeah. And I just, you know, never missed one.
Right.
And now I'm meeting the guy. And I go up to the sixth floor and I'm ushered into his office and I sit. His office is weird. His desk is facing the wrong way.
Okay.
When you come in his office, his desk isn't facing you. You come in, you're behind his desk.
Right.
And he's sitting, leaning up against a bookcase on his chair, and then his two producers are there. And he gestures for me to sit at the desk. I said, not behind the desk. And he goes, absolutely behind the desk. And so I do it. And he's there, and I said, well, the first thing I want to do is throw you all the hell out of my office. And they, being comedy gold,
right,
legends, this is the laugh you get. Right? And no matter what I would say.
Right.
And by the way, there could also be the fact that I'm not so fun.
No,
but
no.
That's the when there are seasoned professionals who've heard it all.
Right.
They do this for a living all day, every day. It's almost like showing a carrot to a chef. Yes, I've seen a carrot before. Right? So that was the thing. The other weird thing about that meeting, by the way?
Yeah.
Heavy metal rock music blasting the entire meeting.
No one turns in the room.
In the room.
And you don't bring it up.
How do you bring it up? Like, it's so weird. They're acting as if there is no music playing.
Right.
And when I tell you, you had to talk like this to be heard. And you think if you're doing this enough, they'll turn down the music. No.
How long was the meeting? Like
3 years, it felt like.
Yeah.
It was probably 20 minutes.
Wow.
And did you ever make him laugh? See, my goal would be I'd be the most irritating person. I'd be trying to make him laugh.
Well, you want to. You want to be that. You want to be funny. You think your job is to be funny.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to be light and day, but the heavy metal music, I thought it was all designed to make me as uncomfortable as possible.
God, isn't that a terrible concept? But it's probably true.
What else could it be?
I mean, I once auditioned. I mean, and people say this too about Christopher Guest.
Yeah.
It's lethal. Like you just
like he has the deadest deadpan.
You come in and he doesn't laugh.
Doesn't
at all,
give it up.
And you just by the time you leave you feel like worthless.
I just met him socially and I thought somebody died.
But
I thought it was him.
You clearly got the gig though. Did you ever like ask them about that meeting or?
No, I was too embarrassed.
Yeah, what are you gonna say?
Yeah.
They treated me as if I had the job already.
Okay.
They said, so how's the show going to be and this and that? And I said very basic things because I just met Ray. I think I'm going to build it around his persona. Maybe they didn't know anything about sitcoms, so they didn't know what to ask.
Right.
But I remember Dave said, just don't embarrass us.
Right.
And I said, oh, that's encouraging. That's what I tell my kids every day when I drop them off at school.
That's a good joke.
But I realized after that I got a call from my agent. Congratulations, you got the job.
Yeah.
What do you mean I got the job? I thought I had the job. I thought that was a formality. No, that was like an audition.
Oh, it's always an audition.
Always
it's always an audition when you do the table read.
Right. If you're a guest actor. You could blow it at the table read.
The hardest thing is the table read.
I actually had to fire an actor once after the table read because for whatever reason, whatever they did in the audition was now completely wrong at the table read. It's horrible for everybody.
It's because an actor thinks wrongly that, it's a nice casual read through. Like when we're going to do, I think that is it's like, oh, I got my cup of coffee. Let's just hear it out loud. You know, in the theater, they do that, but it's wrong.
But it could also be not the actor's fault. It could also be the writer's fault. Hearing it in the context with the other actors, it's now not right anymore. Because when you audition, you're alone.
Right.
And now you're sitting next to your regular cast. Uh-huh. And there's zero chemistry happening, and you don't see it happening.
Right.
And you realize this guy who's going to be the head of the police department has to be imposing to Brad Garrett.
Yes.
Which you didn't see.
In the audition.
Now, you should have seen it if you were smart, but... You know, sometimes you're just seeing what's right in front of you at that moment.
Is there an instance where you would tell the person, we're firing you, it's not you, it's something about the part, we'll bring you back? Or is it too... See, if you just said to the person, we'll bring you back...
I can never promise that because I don't know if that's true.
Well,
I don't know if they're going to... What are we going to bring them back as? Now we got to think of a part... It's like life's
hard
enough.
Give them a little shred of hope, right?
No hope, I'm sorry. We barely have any hope. We're just trying to eke through an existence week to week. We can't. It's just too hard.
I had an experience. You know, this is like when you're at the Yankees. Well, I've had two sort of playing with the Yankees experiences. Many years ago, when I did Cape Fear, totally true story, went out to Hollywood. I never understood that I was famous. I kind of still... So I was in Hollywood, and there was a bus, and it was like a guy with a clipboard saying, you know, you can go see Seinfeld.
Right.
And I was thrilled. I'm like, that's... I
want to go.
I'm like, I want to go to Seinfeld.
Yes.
So I went to Seinfeld, and I'm like sitting in the audience, and somebody came up to me and said, are you Leona Douglas? I was like, yes, that's so nice. You know... Why are you in the audience? Like, do you want to go backstage? Do you want to be in the green room? You know, I was like, oh, is that a possibility?
Wow.
You know, they were like, you're famous. You're in Cape Fear, you know. And so they, you know, suddenly they like brought me away from the people I was on the bus with. They were all insulted to go backstage. And I met everyone. And they were like, you got to come in and audition, you know. Well, so I had a meeting. This is like when the show was not very popular, too. It may have been like second year.
Uh-huh.
And so I met everyone, killed, told funny Robert De Niro stories, et cetera. I never heard from them again. Cut to the final 10 episodes of Seinfeld.
Yep.
I get a call. They want you to be on Seinfeld.
What?
So I'm like,
see?
So
there is hope.
So it just, I waited.
You never know.
But I had to audition.
You did.
Yeah. So I was like, well, what is this? I thought they, oh, God. So I went to the thing. It was like, it was chaos. It was the final 10 episodes.
Yeah.
They said, we're reading a bunch of parts. We don't know which one you're going to be. We just want to get you on one of the last 10 episodes. And I was like, after 10 years, I go, I must have made some impression on you.
They like, remembered you for 10 years. That's nice.
But so they can't, without making this too long, so they, my only goal was just that was my goal, was make them laugh, even if it is completely wrong. Is that
right.
Is that the most? But it worked. So Jerry, I made them laugh. Jerry Seinfeld said, that was really funny, now do this. And but I knew there was no, because I thought, you have to punt and do something spectacular, because I think that if I had just done the material,
yes,
I maybe wouldn't have gotten on the show. And so he had to understand that I could.
I think, though, you better have something really special, because otherwise it's very gutsy, and it's a giant risk.
You got to be gutsy, though.
You're right. You're right.
In
but,
that instance.
But 9 times out of 10, people are gutsy, and they don't have the material to back it up. It's just, and so it's a giant, like, egg on the face moment.
Anyway, I got it. And
amazing.
Then, and then they said, okay, we don't know what you're going to do. And then, you know, that I went to the show and they told me, you're going to be a girl who wears too much tan makeup. And then that's where they put, they kept putting tan makeup on me. And then I had Jerry Seinfeld and staring at me going, I don't know, somehow it's not funny. I go, I look like an Indian. Like, what are you talking about? I'm brown.
Yes.
And they kept going, can you make it more orange? And then I would walk back and then they kept painting like a different color on me. But anyway, I just was trying to hold my own and playing with the Yankees. But when I got into the diner,
Yeah.
It's probably the most afraid I think I've ever been in my life.
Because it's wow. so iconic, the set. Yeah.
Yeah, it really did. It was, and I felt the same way when I did Letterman. There's only been a couple times where I was like, oh, I could actually, right. I could go up. I'm scared. Yeah. When I sat in that booth and I was like, I'm looking at, you know, Jerry Seinfeld. They're looking at you like, what's your problem? You're supposed to talk now.
Oh.
But I had this crazy makeup on and.
Well, that happened to me. I did the bit on 30 Rock.
Yeah.
And I was excited. I love it. And I walk on the set and it's just crew guys there. Let's run it once, they say. And I memorized my little part. It was a couple pages. And I worked. You know,
yeah.
as hard as you can work on a couple of pages,
yeah.
right? Because I cared about it, and I love Tina Fey, and I love the show. But no actors are there. Nobody's there. It's just the crew. Let's run it. Okay, I guess we'll run it. And I start to talk, and I turn to my left, and I hear Alec Baldwin say the line that I'm supposed to do with, and it's Alec Baldwin. And I completely froze because suddenly he was there, and I was terrible, terrible. I went up, I think, every take. I went up at some point during the take. They right. never got a clean one. It had to be put together. And I think Alec Baldwin maybe is mad because I'm terrible.
Still.
I don't know. I love him. He couldn't have been nicer. He told me how much he loved Raymond and how he got hooked on an airplane and now watched it and is talking to me all about it. But the more he talked to me, the more I was, hamana.
Yeah.
It's Alec Baldwin talking to me.
Do you? Right? No, I believe me. I know. Like that's
because he was so great on that show.
Yes, he was.
Talk about iconic, right? He was just amazing, and so I couldn't. Like you're saying, you're suddenly somewhere in life that you never thought you'd be.
Yeah,
and you lose your shit.
But but that you know. But again, you have Jerry Seinfeld looking at your face and yes. going, somehow it's not funny. Like wow. you know, and you're like,
yeah, yes.
it is funny.
Yes. I'm like, funny.
I'm a,
the makeup is not funny. Please understand the difference.
And I'm like, and then you know they kept the. But I love the idea, the science of the comedy. Yes. Somehow on you, it's not me. Can it be more brown? You know.
Great.
So we're dissecting the idea. You know. It's
and
like,
so it feels like you're being dissected.
Yes, of course. Can I be more orange or pink or whatever?
But can you teach someone to be funny?
Yes.
You can take an improv class. I tell people because that. If you are funny, it's going to come out there. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the best class you can take in life
mm-hmm.
because it is a study of life. All of us are improvising all the time. We're mm-hmm. improvising right now.
Yeah.
Right? And God forbid we think about that for a second, then we both freeze up. but that's you've taken improv.
Yes.
You know the number one rule is yes and.
Right.
Which is a philosophy of life when you think about it.
Yeah.
If you and I are doing a scene and you say, have some popcorn, I made it myself in my tub, and then I would say, yes, and I see there's like a ring around the bucket, you know,
uh-huh.
I'm adding something to the material. So it's yes and now maybe we have a scene.
Mm-hmm.
Not that scene, that seemed to be terrible, but the all of life is a building block.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a conversation with a person, you acknowledge what they just said to you, and mm-hmm. then you add something else to the conversation.
Right.
So it teaches you how to – the improv is actually the study of how to be a human being in life.
Yeah.
So that helps you. Now, what is it that makes it funny? That you're going to have to find.
Mm-hmm.
And some people just don't have that bone. You know, the people who give you notes on your comedy script or comedy show, sometimes – they,
yes.
because if they had that gene,
right,
they'd be making the comedy instead of giving the notes on the comedy.
Yes, well, it's and that's when you want to go. I mean, for me in my childhood, it was you know my grandfather giving my parents the 2,000-year-old man.
Oh God!
And
yeah.
so, my theory was being a little kid. And your parents are laughing.
Yeah.
So you have a certain acknowledgement of, oh, whatever is on, I don't really understand what's on
right.
the record.
But you're here laughing.
But what's on the record is yeah. making them laugh. So I think as a child, I strained to understand it
right.
and find the jokes within it
right.
so that I could copy them and make my parents laugh.
I'm pretty sure that's what I did too. You watch the TV shows they watch, and you see them laughing, and then if you can imitate who they were watching and make them laugh, you're just as good.
And then certain things, going back to the album, I find to be universally funny.
Yes.
That are almost like I would say almost like my own personal comedy trademark. And what weirdly is it goes back to the 2000-year-old man. And it almost, I always love the self-deprecating. I don't know if you know the one about the astronaut.
Oh, yeah.
About ill-equipped to go to the...
Right.
Carl Reiner says he goes, "What, ill-equipped? I got gloves and everything." And that, to me, is almost like, for me, is humor.
It's great.
I don't know what that means or why I think that's so funny, but that's my favorite.
That's your favorite joke.
Yeah. Do you have something that is in that... That is almost a philosophy of comedy? Or?
I'm sure I do. I'm blanking now. But I love that so much, what you just said. There's a million of them on that record. I remember he goes, I thought the astronauts were handsome. No, those are poster boys. We're monkeys, man.
We're
look
monkeys.
At me. Yeah.
Monkeys. Yeah. There was another good one on that at the coffee shop where he's talking... He says, you're a very attractive man. He goes, I'm not a man, I'm a woman. Everything on that album became later the basis for for humor for me. And Carl Reiner.
Me
and then,
too. It was a seminal record. It was one of the great things. And there was a collection, 2000-year-old man, 2001, 2013.
Yes.
You know, they put them all out in a box set. It was just... And then it wasn't just the 2000-year-old man sketches. They had these other ones, like the astronaut one. Or the,
yeah.
Man, they were funny. The psychiatric convention.
I loved all of those.
All
and,
of it.
And then later on, of course, then I'd find Elaine Nichols and May, and the Woody Allen one was pretty...
That comedy album, The Stand-Up Years, we got to recommend that to everybody. Because,
the Woody Allen?
Yeah, because...
Yeah.
Pound for pound, line for line, there is no funnier material on the planet.
No.
And a lot of his early movies stemmed right from the record.
Completely.
Right?
Completely.
So I got to meet... Did you ever meet Rollins and Jaffe?
No.
Okay, so I went to... I think it was a screening of Broadway Danny Rose, and Rollins hosted it.
Uh-huh.
And that remains, by the way, my favorite Woody Allen movie.
I think it's my favorite.
Is it? You know why?
It's a killer.
Because you just told me a story before we started about being in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yes.
And getting picked up in a lousy car.
Yes.
And you were going to do a book date.
Yes.
And they had to take you to the bakery first.
Yeah, I was so depressed. I'm in the middle of the night. I'm in the back seat of this kid's car. And he goes, do you mind if we stop at the bakery? My wife. You know, and I'm like, no problem at all. I'm trying to get to the hotel. And
yeah.
And it was I just thought, this is like the bottom of the barrel book tour. I get to the hotel. It's a theme hotel. They have me in the Leon Russell room.
Great.
And I'm just thinking, this is not going to get any worse. And they were like, no, you'll really like it. You know, last week we had Salman Rushdie here on the same book tour. He was in the Patty Page
room. It's amazing.
And I was like, I'm following Salman Rushdie?
Yes, but he had a reason to be there. He was hiding from a fatwa. You didn't really have as good a reason. But the reason Broadway Danny Rose might resonate with you is because it's about the low, low end of show business, which it turns out is 99% of show business.
Absolutely.
Is that bottom.
It. Yeah.
Is that Broadway Danny Rose, who, if you haven't seen it, it's the schleppy manager of the one-armed tap dancer, or the one-legged tap dancer, the guy who makes balloon animals at parties. Yeah. That's most of show business.
Yeah.
And they're playing these little dates, and they're going in their crappy cars, and, 99% of comedy is that.
Right.
You know, driving in the... I remember we're waiting to see if Everybody Loves Raymond is going to get picked up from pilot to series.
Right.
I get a call from Ray. He's on the road with his buddy doing a club date.
Mm-hmm.
Because while waiting, he's out earning a living as a stand-up comic. And he's going to some place in outer New Jersey, and it's the middle of a blizzard.
Right.
And his little car has broken down in a snowstorm. And he's calling me, asking me, have you heard anything yet? That show business, I said, oh, my God, I hope this show goes for Ray's sake.
Yeah.
He's in the snow.
Yes.
Right? So that's why I love Broadway Danny Rose, because it's about that.
Right.
It's about that aspect of showbiz that's so relatable.
Mm-hmm.
So Rollins talked about meeting Woody Allen. Mm-hmm. So Woody Allen, at that time, in the early 60s, this is the time of Bob Dylan in the clubs in Greenwich Village, and people like Joan Rivers and Mort Saul and Bill Cosby were just starting. And he said that he and Jaffe would scout, and they said the bravest person they ever saw in their life was Woody Allen, because he was scared to death to go on stage. He would literally strangle himself in the microphone cord because he was so nervous that he would just get tangled in it until it was like around his neck and he could barely choke it out because he was so petrified of being on stage.
Mm-hmm.
But they listened and the material was killer. And he was bombing every night. He bombed every night for 2 years. He just kept at it.
Wow.
That's a lesson.
Yeah.
Right? That he just kept at this because he had faith in the material. He was selling comedy material when he was 15, 16 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He got a job writing on all these shows. He was a writer for Sid Caesar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? And then he decided, I'm going to go on stage, as awkward and shy and nebbishy as I am, I'm going to go on stage and I'm going to do my own material.
Yeah. No, that's a great, and also Robert Klein had a big effect on me.
He was great too. I had that too.
The early Robert Klein.
Loved him. Albums. But I loved everybody who went on TV to try to get a laugh even.
Yeah, I was talking to Rich Little, this idea,
awesome,
my growing up, of the big change of comedians in tuxedos. You know, that was your idea of Milton Berle and, you know, Bob Hope. But
we were fed a steady diet of kind of the same people.
Yes.
So we all know if you're of a certain age, there were three networks and one Johnny Carson.
Right.
And anyone who went on Johnny Carson was a household name.
Yes.
And could get a TV show.
Mm-hmm.
For almost everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were his favorites. So we know who Rich Little and Dean Martin and the regulars, and especially Don Rickles.
Yeah.
You know, we know these guys.
Even the, you know, Buddy Hackett and...
Of course.
You know, even the people that we are already sort of forgetting, you know.
And there was a respect then, if we're talking about the, let's say, the early 70s.
Right.
There was a respect then for the people that had come 40 years before, like Groucho would be on.
Yes.
Jack Benny would be on. Bob Hope would be on. And they were respected. And there wasn't, because there wasn't this plethora of choices.
Right.
You just accepted it as, oh, this is show business. This is what it is.
It's interesting. I suddenly had this thought that it's almost like the way rock music changed. If, you know, Bob Hope had a whole, you know, he had his group of writers, and Benny had their group of writers, and then the new people that came in, you know, like the Beatles, they're playing, you know, the new comedians are like, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah.
I don't need writers. I can mine my own family and my own life.
Do you think Woody Allen, now that you're talking about it, might be the missing link in a way.
Yeah.
The first guy to, but I guess he would credit Mort Saul.
Right.
For doing that. But Mort Saul was almost too, he was just talking about what was in the newspaper.
Right.
Whereas Woody Allen was talking about himself.
Yeah.
Right? I think he's more important,
a
figure in comedy.
I think so, because again, like you said, he's a bridge from,
yeah.
He admired all those people, Bob Hope.
He really did.
In fact, the first time when I met Woody Allen for an audition, you know, probably in the 80s or whatever, again, they instruct you.
Don't look at him.
Don't look at him. Don't talk to
him.
He'll
melt if you look at him.
But I was determined.
Yeah.
Of course, I think I sort of said under my breath, like, I'm a big Hope and Crosby fan. He goes, oh, yeah? And I was like, yes. Like,
perfect.
Just got something in.
That's
just
perfect.
Hey, you know. Speaking of inspiration.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I was forgetting the.
Just talking.
I know.
I know you got a show to do here.
The do you remember? Do you remember the first movie you saw?
Boy, do I!
Okay.
I devoted the first part of my little book
to this movie because it had such an impact on me. I was 4 years old, and my parents took me to see Mary Poppins.
Mm-hmm. Yay!
Oh, you liked it.
I love Mary Poppins.
So I just saw the trailer, by the way, for the new one, and that looks sweet. I almost got emotional just that they're recreating it. And at first you want to say, don't touch it.
Yeah,
it's my golden, it's my golden thing, right? Don't touch it.
Yeah, yeah.
I wanted to marry Julie Andrews. I 4 years old. I said, don't worry about me, Mom and Dad, because I already picked her out. I know who it's going to be. Aww. I thought, yes, she was magical. I lived in the Bronx, and she lived in or above London. I knew there were problems, but I was going to make it work. If she just met me, I knew we'd get along very well. I loved everything about her. Yeah. I thought she was the greatest. And the movie, you don't even realize when you're little the depth of the film.
Yes.
And so because you don't maybe not realize it, there's a mystery to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a certain dark underside to it.
Very much.
Right? There's even a dark underside to her. Mm-hmm. We're not even sure she likes kids very much by the time we're adults and watching. And there's a sly, like, it's playing on another level if you're a grown-up. Wow, what a sophisticated piece of entertainment that is. Not just the songs, which are brilliant, but the script is brilliant. All the acting is brilliant. I don't care that Dick Van Dyke doesn't have the best English accent. He's the most charming, lovely, wonderful, funny guy. I fell in love with him and wanting to be funny like him in a way, in addition to all the stuff I was watching on TV. But what a magical, beautiful thing. And if you're lucky enough to have kids and show them the movie and sit with them having been a kid and love the movie, it's just glorious.
Did you ever go to Radio City to see movies? When I would visit, my grandparents lived in Queens, so they would, you know, they would always take me to Radio City.
That was nice. And you saw the show then, too. Oh. I mean, talk about entertainment.
The organ came,
first the organ, then the Rockettes. They do it numbers. I think, was there maybe a headliner as well, in addition to the movie? I think early on, maybe there would have been.
Yeah, I didn't get the headliner, but you know, I get the booklet.
Right.
You know, it had like the little promo. They were still the tail end of that, you know, roadshow movie, intermission.
I saw the Sunshine Boys there.
Oh,
talk about funny.
Yeah, that'd be a good one. I think I saw a lot of the Goldie Hawn, Chevy Chase movies there. I think I thought Foul Play, like, again, I'm a kid seeing them. But
why don't they do that?
I don't know. I think we saw Foul Play. I begged my grandmother to see it again. Like, because once you were in the theater,
not that I need to see this, but shouldn't every Star Wars thing play at Radio City? Shouldn't the biggest movies that are family built play Radio City and have the Rockettes come out and do their thing and make it Star Wars themed or whatever? So whoever does this, I would like
make a little piece. make it happen. Okay, I want to talk a little bit quick. Of course, we have to talk a little bit about Everybody Loves Raymond.
You have to.
Again, speaking of... Now, I thought of something as you were talking about that. Was it more fun while you were doing the show and being recognized and feted, or is it more fun after the show knowing it's a great success and you can rest on your laurels?
Well, not resting. Maybe I should. Maybe today is the day I start resting.
It's like writing a book. You know, where it's like it's horrible to write. I hated every minute of writing it.
Yes,
but it's like I wrote a book.
You ever been in a writer's room, like a comedy writer's room?
Yes,
it's the most fun place on earth. It really is. I don't. And people ask me, "You missed the show?" I don't miss the show. The show is done. The show, we actually ended the show on our terms. When we ran out of ideas, we stopped the show after 9 years was enough.
That's a good run.
Very good run of anything. But enough. So what I miss, though, are my friends in that room.
Yeah, the in jokes and
just, you know, you're imagine being 9 years in a room with people.
Yeah.
This is more than high school and college put together.
Right.
So they're family, so I make an effort to see them as much as possible. In fact, I'm having dinner with them tonight.
Aww.
Because one of us is turning 80.
What?
Ooh.
And we're going out tonight.
That's amazing. To celebrate.
Isn't that nice?
Yes.
So I love that. I treasured every second of that show while it was happening because I knew how rare it was just to get a show on the air. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, to have any success beyond that, it's not, they say it's like winning the jackpot. It isn't. It's like winning the jackpot over and over and over again.
Well,
with every little notch of success and awards and you know, just fun.
Uh-huh.
That's everything.
What I miss about a show like Everybody Loves Raymond is like, see, that's like my grandmother, who's Italian, you know, and I'm sure you've heard this 80 million times, would be like, that's us. You know, like, and you know what I mean? That idea that there was a show that you could watch as a family and relate to it. And
I love that.
Has it just gone away? Or
it did change.
It's harder.
It changed. It, like, the reason you haven't seen another sitcom from me is because the business did change.
Right.
And people want to be in business with me, but only because of the success that they saw that show had.
Right.
They don't want that show anymore, meaning that type of entertainment. What they want is something way hipper, way edgier.
Ugh.
Right?
Yeah.
By the way, they wanted it then. We would get notes. Could you make it a little more hip and edgy? I'm like, who are you talking to?
Doris Roberts?
Yes, yes.
Make her hip and edgy.
Could you make it a little hotter and sexier? Yeah, we'll put Doris in a bikini for you. What are you talking about? Why did you buy the show if you wanted hot and sexy, hip and edgy?
Yeah.
This is not, first of all, me. I'm not.
Yeah.
Look at Raymond.
Oh, God.
But that's, I don't get it. I don't, and part of it's my fault because I'm not willing to capitulate and go that way.
Right.
For them.
Uh-huh.
So they're not coming to meet me halfway, and I'm really not going to meet them halfway either. But the show I have now, not to make a bad segue, but that show literally is the culmination of all my values.
Mm-hmm.
It is for the family. You can watch it. I make sure not to curse in the show. I make sure not to have anything risque. If there is something risque, it's a raised eyebrow that goes over the kids' heads. Nobody has to be afraid to watch with grandma. And it's relatable in the fact that everyone I'm meeting on planet Earth is relatable.
Right.
Because it's about the people. The food and hopefully the humor is just the way to get you, to hook you in.
Mm-hmm.
But the Raymond sensibility, if you like that, it's still there.
Yeah.
And the kind of message of relatability and harmony and that we're all the same, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, we get letters from Sri Lanka on Raymond. That's my mother. How do I know your mother in Sri Lanka? I was writing my mother. It turns out that that's the relatable thing. The more specific we get, the more relatable it is.
It is. It is. The relationship. Now, it seems to me that the casting of Peter Boyle is a bit of a wild card.
Yes.
Did you have any?
That was Les Moonves' idea.
Oh, it was.
We're casting the show, and he goes, what about Peter Boyle for the father? I had no idea that movie star Peter Boyle. We even wanted to do television. I didn't. I was bringing in, you know, TV guys to do it. And he said, what about Peter Boyle? I don't know. Maybe he had spoken to Peter Boyle at a party and Peter had expressed interest maybe in sitcoms or whatever. Or Les was just a genius and pulled his name out of a hat.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. But I met Peter Boyle.
Did he seem funny or did
he scared the shit out of me. I gave him the part. Like, yes,
he's
whatever
a taxi
you want.
Driver. It's like, I don't remember.
Or Joe.
Yeah, Joe is.
Where he killed punks like me for breakfast.
Yeah.
So, yes, I was
the candidate.
Great actor.
I mean, great turnaround of a career there.
Amazing. And then, but don't you know that backstory on him kind of gave him this gravitas in the role where you were like, oh, that's daddy.
Right.
You know, that's, you're not messing with him. And the only person he's afraid of, his wife.
Right. And then Doris Roberts, of course. What a gem.
Genius. Brilliant. We saw 100 women for that part.
Oh, yeah.
You know, she read this thing, the scene that really happened to me in life. I gave my parents fruit of the month, and they acted like I gave them a box of heads from a murderer. Like a terrible thing. And she doesn't look like my mother. She doesn't sound like my mother, but she got the essence of my mother.
Yeah.
And that was it for me.
And the casting, what about Ray and...
Ray had no choice. He came with the show.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, and then what about chemistry with Brad Garrett?
Oh, my God. So, Brad, Ray's older brother,
Right.
is shorter than Ray, which I thought is great because the older brother is going to be jealous of the younger brother if the younger brother is taller than him.
Right.
Then you're jealous of your older your younger brother your whole life.
Yeah.
In addition to being mom's favorite. So we're looking for a shorter guy. And then a talking tree came in the room. Brad. And he starts with his voice. Like yeah. And we fell over laughing. It was better than anything any of us had considered.
Yeah.
Sometimes that magic happens.
Yeah.
Too, right? Where something that you never dreamed possible. That's Brad Garrett.
That's funny because we were saying before, like, sometimes when I was being serious, people would just start laughing. He seems to have that quality.
Absolutely.
Is it just the voice and the height?
The voice, the height, and he's got one of the great... I'd say this about the cast uniformly. They all have something I love in comedians, which is a straight face.
Uh-huh.
All of them.
Mm-hmm.
They all, you know, it's what we loved about Carol O'Connor.
Mm-hmm.
That deadpan. When Edith starts a long story.
Right.
And you just see his mind working as he rolls his eyes a tiny, tiny, tiny bit and then mimes the different ways he's going to kill himself while she's talking. The greatest thing ever.
That's true. The ability to listen. And the other thing is
to know what they're thinking.
Yeah.
That's everything.
Yeah. To take that in, it's like, you know, one person doing the funny thing and then the other person almost being the eyes of the audience.
Exactly. Once the audience knows
like,
what you're...
Do you see what I'm saying? Yeah.
Once they know what you're thinking, it's like you've opened the door. That's
right.
Everything.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're getting laughs before they speak. I'll tell you this. So we write dialogue for the people.
Yeah.
During the taping... Somebody says something, and now here comes our punchline that they're going to say. But the audience is already laughing at the look on their face, and it's way better than what we wrote. And in editing, we take the line out because the face was actually better than the line.
Right.
You don't need the line. The line is just a extra.
Yeah. It's the situation. Now, there is on YouTube, I was watching bloopers.
Oh, they're funny.
I mean, one of the great things about bloopers, you can see everyone's really getting along.
Then you get the sense that you're part of a wonderful family.
Yeah.
And Raymond, especially, loved creating bloopers. In other words, after the work is done and we're about to start shooting, meeting in Ray's dressing room,
mm-hmm.
let's go over some take twos.
Mm-hmm.
We call them take twos. Can we do better than the joke that's here, number one? Or can we make something so outrageously funny that will never be in the show, that'll just be for the gag reel, the bloopers, and make the audience who's sitting there at the show feel like they're part of something special.
Yes.
And it's just fun to crack up Peter Boyle.
Right.
Right? And so we would do that.
Yeah.
And it was so much fun.
Yeah, there's a couple in particular. I guess my favorite one is where Patricia Heaton accidentally kicks him in bed.
Yeah.
And he's got 20.
Oh, yeah. He had a list of jokes he wanted to do.
Uh-huh.
And we just did them all.
Is that... When I worked on the Drew Carey show, it was like there was the show and then there was the real show. Like when we were doing it, everything.
Yeah.
They would rewrite stuff and put it on a napkin and then you would... It would all... Did you ever have that where every... Drew liked to be very, very... Talk about improv.
Yeah.
He liked to just kind of throw everything out. And like, again, you'd get new lines and new jokes.
But
and,
after he'd already gotten it the written way, or no?
Yeah, but I think he felt... deflated. Like if something didn't go through the roof in the audience, they'd toss it and then you'd suddenly be given a new line.
Well, you do want to see if you can do better on multiple takes.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially you have the luxury of doing it more than once.
Right.
So why not? Why not change it up?
Mm-hmm.
Especially, by the way, sometimes it went perfectly well.
Right.
Can we do even better?
Right.
Why not? These are plug and play jokes.
Yeah.
We're not changing the plot of the story with these lines. This is you can say literally anything here
mm-hmm.
as long as it's funny.
Right. We were talking before about like, you know, bad notes that you'd get from and like what is your reaction when someone, I mean for those writers out there,
yeah,
when you get notes from executives, like, what's the best way?
So a good I want to preface what I'm about to say.
Speaking of deadpan faces,
you want to
how do you take notes, yes, correctly?
Yes. I want to say a good note can come from anywhere. Mm-hmm. And you're stupid not to listen.
Right.
Because you never know. Mm-hmm. First of all, the network executive is probably the first person outside your writer's room to see the material.
Right.
Right? So you want a human, another human, and they are, at the very least, I think, sometimes human. And so you want that. You want the feedback.
Uh-huh.
Now, if it's really dumb, you don't have to do it. You think you do. Mm-hmm. You want them to like you. Mm-hmm. The best advice I ever got from anybody was from Ed Weinberger, great showrunner. I've said this a million times, but it's so worth repeating. Mm-hmm. Do the show you want to do, because in the end, they're going to cancel you anyway. Right? So you mentioned Elaine May before. I happen to know her, and she gave me great advice as well. She said, when somebody's giving you a note, just nod, and once in a while go, oh, let me get a pencil. Let me write that down. Because everyone just wants to feel validated.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Here's something that I thought, and this is a mistake I made for years until, I'm going to say, very recently.
Right.
You get a dumb note. I want to be nice, and I want to be collaborative, and I want to respect you, so I'm going to explain to you why.
Right.
That may not work, and I'm going to tell you why it won't work, okay, because we're all in on this together, and here's what I might do instead, but here's why that note maybe is not right for this moment, right? Mm-hmm. Niceness can be just like that. Mm-hmm. Guess what? They hate you, because here's what you did. You just showed them that they're wrong.
Right.
You just showed them that they're maybe, and this is what they're thinking, they're not good at their jobs. Mm-hmm. And you're the person that made them feel that way, and so they don't like you anymore. And so you're now the enemy. So just being nice and explaining the thing, it doesn't work.
Right.
It, by the way, not to get political, but maybe some of the problem we have is that the number one problem is people don't want to admit they're wrong.
Oh.
Okay?
Yeah.
Right? When I'm not saying what side I'm on or anything. But I think you know. But that's a problem. So you can't just trying to be rational and that just nod, accept it. They just want you to accept it. Why? Because they have a million other notes for a million other shows and they just want to move on. Mm-hmm. They want you to hear it. Yes, if they're sticklers, they want you to do it.
Right.
But they can't make you. Mm-hmm. So listen, accept it, say yes. You know, I always say, we'll take a look at that.
Right.
I'll get a pencil is even better.
Because that's improv. You said yes, and
that's right. I'm getting a not pencil. Only am I accepting what you're saying, I'm writing this down, right? But Elaine comes from the time when you used a pencil,
right?
let me take out my phone and use
but
my
what
thumbs.
What about
to
the
put
idea
this in?
that I mean, I'm getting a little deep cuts here, but that a written joke or a premise took a week's worth of work and is very, very well constructed and thought out.
Right.
And so if somebody hates it and you have to write something on the fly.
Yes. That's what's wrong with a lot of things is that we're so ready to change it because we're afraid that they won't like it. They won't, the show won't go. But I tell everyone this same thing, do the show you want to do because in the end they're going to cancel you anyway, because you have one shot. I quit Raymond twice before we got on the air because of this very thing.
Uh-huh.
Because of big things that I would not do.
Right.
And I knew that if I did them, there would be no show. Mm-hmm. So I literally walked away from the show twice.
Wow.
And I wasn't bluffing. Mm-hmm. Turns out that the walking away got their attention. Mm-hmm. Maybe he knows something. Maybe he has, what is the word, integrity? Right? Maybe he's the guy.
Yeah.
It turns out that I earned respect by doing this. Mm-hmm. It's not what I was doing. I wasn't trying to do that. I was literally out of bullets. I didn't know what to do, so I ran away. Mm-hmm. But that turned out to be the right thing to do. So I tell kids when I go on college tours, always quit.
Yeah. No, yeah, the key is you got to do it with sincerity.
You can't just quit, oh, my tea is cold. I quit.
it doesn't, no, you have to have just driven as far as you can. You go, you had to try to make that train right. Stay on the tracks as much as you could.
Yes.
But I'm telling you, if you feel too compromised, if the show is too now not what you had set out to do, mm-hmm. your name is on this thing.
Right.
It represents you. Mm-hmm. We only have our name. Mm-hmm. We only have our work. You have to have a little shred of integrity. Right. You have to say, I'm not going to be part of this. I'm not going to, mm-hmm. you know, put crap out into the world with my name on it.
Right.
I leave now.
I was suddenly thinking about, there was a pilot I was involved with where they just wanted it. It seemed like they wanted it to fail. So they'd mm-hmm. come down and the audience was screaming, laughing, and they'd go, we hate her hair. And they'd make all of us change our hair or change our outfits.
Because that's the only thing they know how to comment on, maybe.
Really?
That's their contribution.
So, but I've seen it every way. Like, I've seen it where I've done shows and they have acquiesced to every single note.
Yep.
And not get picked up.
Of course.
And I've seen things where they've fought every bit of the way.
And got picked up.
And no, and got canceled. Like, so.
Yes, of course, because
There
is no rhyme or reason, and the odds of getting picked up are very slim anyway. So why not do it your way? It doesn't mean, again, not to listen to anybody. Listen to everybody.
Yes.
And then make the decision that you feel, because you're the one who wrote it. Yeah. You're the one who knows better.
Yes.
Apparently. Otherwise, they would do it without you. Believe me, they would. If they could save a nickel, they would do it without you.
Okay, we got. I want to get to Somebody Feed Phil, but we have to touch on a little bit of you're going to Russia, of course, and trying to do, because that was such a great documentary.
Thanks.
I think that was the first time I ever heard on the. That was how I became aware of you, not just the show, because hearing you on NPR, and I said, that sounds really funny. This sounds like it's such a great premise for a funny film to go to Russia and do Everybody Loves Raymond. I mean, it just sounded like it was made up.
It wasn't made up. It was a real thing. The head of Sony asked me if I would be interested in going to Russia, where Sony invented the sitcom. It didn't exist until Sony did The Nanny over there. Uh-huh. They translated The Nanny into Russian and cast Russian actors, and it became a big hit. And then they started doing other shows. But he said the people that work on the shows from Russia, this is a new thing. Mm-hmm. So they didn't have a sitcom department. So they came from the news. They came from soap operas. Right? I'm like, why? Mm-hmm. They said, because they're also a half hour. The head of comedy had only previously worked with laser beams. I'm like, why? They said, sitcom is new technology.
Yeah.
So they thought that this would be a new thing. And he was the most advanced scientific mind that they could have. Not a stick of humor in this body. Mm-hmm. But by the way, the point of exporting Raymond is I meet the same faces at networks here who have not a shred of comedy in them.
Right.
And they may as well be head of laser beams.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Well, wasn't there I was reading one of the woman who was like the costumer who was giving you notes.
Yes. I got notes from the costume lady telling me that the women on the show should be dressed very finely in fine evening wear. And then I'm like, you understand this takes place, 90% of the show takes place in the kitchen. They said, why would someone want to see someone dressed like that?
Uh-huh.
I'm like, because that's how the people at home are being dressed. Yes, but we don't want anyone else to see us dressed that way.
Uh-huh.
You're on television. You should be dressed up because you're on television. I said, I understand, but she doesn't, in the show, she doesn't know she's on television. You're trying to explain.
And at what point did you realize how funny this, like when you went
when
there?
When I met that costume lady at the first meeting on the first day.
See, this is going to be crazy.
As soon as she started talking, she was like, dress nice and look beautiful. So right away you know, I'm in another land. The whole movie's a comedy, I think.
Yeah.
Even though it's a documentary, it's a comedy about a guy, an idiot named me,
yeah.
who thinks he's an expert in something.
Yes.
Everybody Loves Raymond. Yeah. And goes to a land where they've asked him to come to help them make Everybody Loves Kostya. Okay. And I thought, like a moron, they would listen to me.
Yeah.
No.
It sounds like a Will Ferrell movie.
It really does. And By the way, when the head of Sony asked me if I'd be interested in going to Russia, it wasn't to do this. He thought I would go observe how they work with these people and come back and write a Will Ferrell comedy about a showrunner who goes to Russia to have his show translated. And that was my idea. Was, wait a minute. If these people really exist, why not bring a camera crew and film what would really happen? And he goes, I love that idea. Would you be the guy? Yeah. Go to Russia and make Raymond over there. So that's an adventure. I had to do it.
And would you, I mean, I hate to say this, Russia's not a place I would look forward to visiting.
I had to do it. It sounded like, first of all, it was going to be a transition for me into movies.
Right.
I got to direct a documentary, right? In addition to be in it, which I didn't think twice about because here's my directorial style on the film. I said, let's bring two cameras. That's it. Because I think the thing's going to be about how they react to me and how I react to them. That's the movie.
Yeah.
But once that decision was made, I forgot all about directing a film, and I was just there to do my job. They asked me to come and help them, and then sure enough, disaster.
Yeah. Well, it reminds me of why you like Pittsburgh with Jeff Goldblum.
Yes, I love it.
Because, again, the premise was all true.
Yes.
Jeff Goldblum wanted to do The Music Man.
Right.
They did not want him.
Hysterical.
And he couldn't believe it. Like, I'm Jeff Goldblum. I'm a big star.
Yes.
Why doesn't my hometown of Pittsburgh
want me?
Want me? And they said, well, if you want to audition, you know. So he auditioned to be in. They still didn't want him.
Oh, my God. It's so funny.
And then they said, well, you know, do you have any other celebrity friends? Maybe if you had some friends to round out. And with all of that and the fact that we were sold out, the director thought he was an expert on The Music Man, and he thought that Jeff Goldblum was the worst Music Man he'd ever seen.
It's so great.
And again, no matter what Jeff did, he was crumbling. And so again,
there's nobody more talented than Jeff Goldblum, and it just shows you it never ends.
Yeah,
I can't tell you how many people will call me. Can you come on the TV show? Oh, thank you. And could you bring Ray? Thanks.
Why would they want to bring you? Why would we, you know, he's transitioned to a serious actor now, though.
He's a great actor, isn't he? Don't you think he's great?
He's wonderful. He was in the Scorsese,
Final.
Yes,
and now
Final.
Now he's in the next one.
Oh,
he's with De Niro and Pacino in the what's it called?
The
Irishman.
Yeah, well, you know, Marty's very funny, and I think he has a theory anyway that funny people can be good actors and serious. And
so listen to this. Before Vinyl, right, they brought him Ray to audition. He'd never heard of Everybody Loves Raymond, Marty. That's right.
Yeah.
Ray was like, oh, no.
Well, Ray, you know, Marty only watches one channel, which is Turner Classic Movies.
Hilarious.
So yeah, he doesn't see any other images, you know.
He lives in the bubble.
Yeah, he only wants to see movie images.
Great.
So that's why he wouldn't see
but
that.
But I'm very proud of Raymond. He's doing this new one. He was great in The Big Sick, right? He held his own.
Yeah.
He's really good.
Yeah, which is not easy to do, transition.
Never acted before Everybody Loves Raymond.
Really?
Never.
Wow.
He was fired. He got onto a show, news radio maybe? He was fired the first day. He was fired after the table read.
Oh, no. You gotta push it at the
table.
Thank
God for that.
You gotta push it.
Maybe less than one day of rehearsal. But I know it's going bad. And this informed the rest of his life. It's going to end any second. I'm going to get fired from life.
Yeah. Well, I believe in that. I always feel I'm going to be fired. But then they just ask me if I want lunch. Like with a drink, they come to your trailer. I'm like, I'm fired, aren't I?
No.
No, we were going to see if you wanted to have lunch.
Oh, good.
Oh,
at least I get lunch. And then I'm fired. If I'm going to be fired today, at least I'm eating.
That's all I care about, the food.
Yes, me too.
Okay, so doing the show and the documentary led to your food show.
Yep, because somebody saw that and said, we like the idea of you going places.
Right.
I said, so does my wife. And so they asked if I had an idea, and I did. I had this idea. What if I went around the world and tried to get you to travel by showing you the best place in the world to eat? And I got this thing, started on PBS, and I called my brother, who was a producer in television.
Mm-hmm.
I said, quit your job. He goes, why? He goes, you don't have to, here's something fun to produce. He goes, what? I got just got this show. Go around the world and eat. He goes, they're giving you that show. Yeah. What are you going to call it? The Lucky Bastard? So, I'm like, we can't call it that on PBS, but we can call our production company that. We'll call it Lucky Bastards if you come with me.
Aww.
And he did.
That's great.
Yeah.
And so now it's Somebody Feed Phil.
That's right, on Netflix.
On Netflix.
You can see both series, by the way, on Netflix, and you can see Exporting Raymond on Netflix.
Oh, you
the
can?
The whole oeuvre.
Wow. How'd you come up with the title?
Somebody Feed Phil?
Yeah, that's the hardest
part. I had to change it.
I know, because I got the email from you, and what were some of the bad? Do you remember some of the bad?
Oh, there's so many bad ones, but
some of the bad.
Well, a cute one was Eat Phil Love.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah, they didn't want that.
Oh,
there's so many.
Somebody Feed Phil.
I have a whole list in my pocket. I just can't remember all
of
them.
You're like Milton Berle with a file.
Well, I had a long time to wait, you know, so I had time to think of what the new name would be.
Yeah.
But I think Somebody Feed Phil, the reason I like it is it implies that, like, you came home from work and the dog didn't eat yet.
Yeah.
And you ask, Somebody Feed Phil? I'm the dog.
Yeah.
So it suggests a character that needs to be fed.
Yes.
And then it also is a bit of a connection to Everybody Loves Raymond.
Oh.
If you think about that, which itself is a throwback to I Love Lucy.
Yes.
So I kind of like the historical connection.
I like the idea because I totally believe, you know, this idea. I mean, humor, too, sometimes unites us, but food definitely.
The great connector.
I mean.
Right? We have to eat. And so when we eat, if we're at least not killing each other.
Yeah.
We're bonding over something at least. And if the food is good, it's even better. And then if we laugh.
Yeah.
See, if food is the great connector, then laughs are the cement. If we laugh, now we're friends. And now we're going to eat again.
Yeah. No.
And I think that a lot of the world's problems could be solved over...
breaking bread.
Yeah.
I absolutely believe that. I think I told you this. I've been trying to perfect my matzo ball soup. I like to cook.
Oh, I got a great one for you.
Yeah, so I've been, you know, working on it and working
on it. You're
going
to let me taste it, right?
Yes.
You're going to bring it over?
Yes.
I'm excited.
You have to be the I feel like then the final, it must come full circle. I want to feed Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner eventually.
We can arrange it.
Yeah. But I've been perfecting it until it's like, it's got to be like bang.
Do you want to taste someone else's? Because I want to suggest one that's really, really, like the best. I'm going to say the best matzo ball soup I've ever had is in L.A. right now.
Where?
It's a new place that just opened a few weeks ago. It's called Jaffa.
Okay.
Middle Eastern restaurant.
Okay.
Israeli.
Wasn't he on your show?
Jaffa?
Was he on your show?
No.
Oh, okay. I'm thinking
Jaffa is a place in Israel. It's right in Tel Aviv, next to Tel Aviv.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost got a Moroccan flavor. So it has a very strong flavor.
Okay.
But to me, flavor is everything. So that's what makes this one the best to me.
Okay.
Because sometimes it can be very bland. And it can be comforty.
Mm-hmm.
But what if you just amped up all the garlic and turmeric and stuff in there and it just tasted amazing, the dill and the parsnips and all that stuff.
Yes.
And had a really strong flavored broth.
The broth is everything. Now, my broth is on point.
Great.
Unbeatable. It's but the matzo ball itself, I've been experimenting with chicken fat, non-chicken fat. And so I don't have the rate. I want to get the broth is on point.
Meaning, are you studying other books or are you just experimenting yourself?
Mainly I look at other books and then I do it myself with taste. I sort of feel like I'm an expert on broth. My broth is on point.
I'm excited.
So to me, that's
and the quality of your chicken is very, very important too.
Yes. So there's all of that. But again, my point was that I never in my life through Instagram or Facebook had the amount of input into people making my soup and their soup. And now you've inspired me to make soup. And so again, I do think this idea, dumplings are another one, you know, people love
it's a universal thing.
Yeah.
Right. Every culture has the dumpling.
Yeah.
And usually in soup.
Yeah.
Right.
And it gives us something to talk about other than politics or.
Absolutely.
You know, something like that.
What made you pick matzo ball soup?
Because I'm not Jewish. And, well, I mean, I've got like a little bit of Jewish in me. My grandfather was part Jewish. But it was something I wanted to, I love to cook, mm-hmm. and I wanted to master, and I just thought, I went.
You like it.
I went, and then I had bought from, I don't want to say, a local deli, and I just thought, God, this is really expensive, and I think I could do better.
Yes.
Is what I ultimately, and I said, you know what? I'm going to work on this. I said, because this is one of those things that will really knock people's socks off if yeah. you could
make a deluxe one.
Rather than having to go yeah. order it.
Yeah. A lot of it is just dishwater. It's nothing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like just bland, and they just think the name of it is comfort enough.
Right.
But you could, to do a real good one.
I always think, like, again, comes back to my, you know, my Italian grandmother, you know, you wouldn't, I mean, the FedEx guy, she'd be like, are you hungry? Do you want something to eat? You know, so nobody would ever even enter your house without feeding them. So I was thinking it'd be really, really interesting to like have people over and talk to them, but then also feed them. So, but I wouldn't travel, you know, I don't know if I'd want to travel around the world.
No.
Because you have to eat a lot.
Yeah, so.
Well, I wanted the eating
You
part.
Say that like it's a bad thing.
No, I love watching you do it, and it makes me really hungry.
You wouldn't want to go.
Because
I was going to invite you.
Oh, okay. Like I said, I'd love to go. It would depend. Like, have you been to Sweden yet?
No, but I went to, I'm not allowed to say.
Okay, don't say. But when you go to the Nordic countries, yes, I'd love to.
That you like.
Yeah.
I'll go to and translate.
Do you see these? I was invited to go on one of these river cruise things.
Yes.
Have you done that?
Well, I went on a big sea cruise, and I went on a river cruise in Georgia.
Oh.
So that was kind of fun. Savannah.
Yeah.
They if that's the same type of thing.
This is a big company that does the river cruises. You see uh-huh. them advertised all the time. But.
Is it like Showboat? Like, are the people singing?
God, I hope not.
Are they going up and down the river?
It looks a little more sophisticated. Is it,
okay. I think they had one. They had one in. They had one in Connecticut. Okay, we're running out of time.
I'm afraid of a cruise. I think. I think because you're trapped, it's like being just trapped in a hotel.
Right.
Yes.
Right. For
but
days
on a river
and days.
Cruise, you can see the shore, and so that one's okay with you.
I think the river cruise, you actually get off every day. And maybe you can take a bike and meet the crews up the river
right
later or do something, anything you want on shore all the time, like very little time on the boat.
I liked being on a cruise because it's like, but again, I always had the fantasy of being an 85-year-old person. So like if that's,
oh, you know what? Me too.
Yeah. So yes, if that's your like. Oh, this is great.
Oh, you know what we're going to do in a few years?
Yeah.
Here's the escape plan. There's something called The World. It's a cruise ship called The World.
Okay.
It travels around the world and people buy apartments on it. And there are old people who rather than go to the nursing home or the assisted living, they just do that. I think the price is comparable.
Uh-huh.
And you're traveling around the world. But you have full medical, right? All meals taken care of. Room service.
Yeah.
This sounds brilliant to me.
I love this idea. I'm in.
Please. I'm telling my descendants.
Yes.
When daddy gets old enough, just put me on one of those.
Put me on a ship.
Isn't that better?
Yes. You have to plan an exit strategy.
I think so. Some of us may have to plan sooner than that.
I want to get to Spanglish, a rather underrated film. Did you enjoy being a part of that?
Loved every second.
Yeah, it really captures a side of L.A. That is very specifically L.A. That's what I like about it.
I played a sous chef. I met Jim Brooks.
Mm-hmm.
He heard me speak at a seminar, writer seminar. I looked out in the audience and said, friggin' Jim Brooks, why is he here listening to us talk? This guy, we should be listening to him.
Yeah.
I didn't understand it. Maybe he was doing one down the hall and he came in and said, let's look at some monkeys. And he looked at us. We're monkeys, man. And afterwards he goes, hey, you ever do any acting, man? That's how he talks, man. He says man all the time. And I said, years ago, high school, college, he goes, give me your number. I might have something for you. I'm like, what? Don't fuck with me, Jim Brooks, because I'll only drop everything to follow you.
Yes.
You know, I was running Raymond at the time. So I said, listen, if we could just have lunch, that'd make my life, right? Mm-hmm. And we have lunch and we become friends. And I get him into food.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's
never gotten into food. He got me a little into wine. He loves wine. Mm-hmm. I love food. And so I'm showing him all the great place to eat in L.A. It was so much fun for me to be able to turn someone like that on to something is great. But I never mentioned this thing, even though it's in the back of my mind. Mm-hmm. He said he had something. What is that? Well, it turns out he was writing this whole time.
Yeah.
2 years later. 2 years. Remember I said I had something for you? Yeah, I had forgotten about it now. Yeah, it's time. You'd have to read for me because, you know, I just got to make sure. But we're friends now, so it's weird. So can you put yourself on tape?
Oh, God.
And I said, you know, I'm running the show now. He goes, but I think that's the only way. And I go, all right. And I push the button on my phone. I say to my casting person at Raymond, Lisa Miller Katz, could you come in my office with your video camera? Jim Brooks wants me to go on tape for something. And she goes, you?
That's confidence.
What's that for a vote of confidence?
And she came in, and I did it twice, and I said, Lisa, you pick the one you think is better and send it to him, and I'm not going to think about this ever again. And thank you, and please don't tell anyone this happened. And she mailed it. So now I'm doing okay, right? I'm running a show, a successful show. The only thing I can think about for 3 days is why hasn't Jim Brooks called me? I must be awful.
Yeah.
3 days later, he calls. So, how are you doing? Okay. Oh, he's asking how I'm doing. I didn't get to. He goes, and we're chit-chatting. And the whole time I'm going, this is so humiliating. This is his way of telling me. And he goes, so, you're good. I said, yeah, but. He goes, no, you're good. I think you should do this. You want to do it?
Oh, my God.
I said, only since I'm 5.
Jesus. Yeah. The drama.
I know.
Lucky bastard.
And then I do it. And Thomas Keller, the great chef, was the consultant on the movie. And so I spent time with him in his kitchen. I spent time. I was a sous chef, meaning an assistant chef to Adam Sandler, who was the head chef. Mm-hmm. And so I had to learn some skills.
Yeah.
So I go and I train at Spago and I train at the French Laundry or Per Se in New York and Jar and all these places. I'm learning a little bit, not enough to be good or anything, but I learn enough to fake it.
Yeah.
And the kitchen set that we were on was an exact replica at Sony of the French Laundry kitchen in Napa. And Thomas Keller was on set the entire time. And we became friends, too. It was fun.
Amazing. Well, that's what movies, you know, some of these relate, you know, sometimes playing someone in a film.
Yeah. If you're lucky enough, the movie can be this great learning experience for you in an unexpected, great way. I spoke to Margot Robbie. Mm-hmm. She learned how to be a world-class skater for that movie. Everybody thinks that, it's all CGI. There's one CGI shot in that film.
Yeah.
Where she does the triple axle. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Yeah.
Every single other thing. And she practiced day and night. She practiced the day of her wedding. She was practicing. Mm-hmm. That's dedication.
Yeah. No, people don't realize that sometimes some of the fun skills that you pick up doing a movie or going, I mean, some of... I got a million. I'm going to prisons or, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Learning how to work on a loom.
Right.
You know, just things that you wouldn't do in a million years. But somehow movies give you that special magic that you're like, I know how to do this. And then the movie's over and you don't know how to do it anymore.
Because you have to.
I guess so.
But, you know, most of life is just showing up, right? Fake it till you make it.
My last question, do you have a favorite film? I know we have movie nights at your house, which are amazing.
I have so many.
I thanked you in my book.
Oh,
that's right. Sweet. You're in the intro. I thank you for the movie nights. I would write and I would only look forward to relaxing and seeing a movie. I think I only fell asleep once during Mad Max.
You know that for some reason, the constant noise of something like that. I fall asleep in the big action films like Star Wars when it's just computer graphics fighting.
Yeah.
I'm out.
I don't know.
I don't care.
Yeah.
And every superhero movie is now just, it's not even, you're seeing the suits are fighting. You know there's no one in the suits.
Yeah.
They're drawings.
Yeah.
Drawings are fighting. I don't care.
Yeah.
And so even at 17, I waited online all day for Star Wars, the original. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I'm old enough to have been there. And the big fighting chew, chew, chew at the end. Chew, chew. Me. Really?
Okay, I don't feel as bad.
Yeah.
I was sitting next to someone and I was like, oh my God, I slept through.
Yes, I happen to like people.
Yeah.
That's what's interesting.
And people talking. Yes. So do you have a
favorite movies?
Favorite movies?
You were just telling me about movies you liked this year.
Maudie and Stronger, I think, were two overlooked films. I did love The Florida Project, which we saw at your house.
With the writer, yeah. Right? With,
Chris Bergosh, who we had on the show here.
Oh, how great is he? How great is that movie? That movie should have been up for Best Picture. Movie, to me, should have won Best Picture.
Yeah, it was a great film.
I think it was the best film this year. It's our 400 Blows or Bicycle Thief.
Yeah, I loved it. It'll be rediscovered. It's just odd. They just, all the movies come out at the same time. And you can't possibly see all of them. And
you know what one of their inspirations was for the movie was The Little Rascals. Did Chris talk about that
with you? Yes.
I thought that while I was watching it.
Yeah.
You know, The Little Rascals, you forget, was made during the Depression, which now if you watch it, there's an underlying sadness. These are kids unsupervised trying to make their way in the world, you know, trying to get like scraps of food when you think about it.
Yeah.
It was kind of amazing, but we were too busy laughing at how cute the kids were.
Oh, well, that's true. Well, the underpinnings of all comedy, that's why The Honeymooners is so great. It's always like this, some
desperation,
a dream, like just something quite out of reach. That's why comedy, again, changed so much for me when it's about, you know, and that's why he's on a camel, you know, and like everything became about funny words.
Or
a
sex joke.
Yeah.
Because the sex joke keeps it on one tiny superficial level.
Right.
Whereas if you watch The Honeymooners, there was never ever a sex joke. That wasn't allowed.
Yeah.
So it had to be about the much deeper, better, human, relatable, timeless things.
Yeah. Right. That was always
the human comedy of trying to better your station in life.
Oh, pathos.
Yeah.
My favorite word. Okay, you didn't mention your favorite.
Absolute favorite? Well, Mary Poppins.
Mary Poppins.
Godfather 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to pretend there was no 3.
Yes.
Jaws.
Jaws.
Just a killer movie.
You know, I saw Poltergeist. I hadn't seen it in years.
Yeah? How's it hold up?
Huh.
Yeah?
Incredible.
Great.
Incredible. And I watched the featurette.
Yeah.
Directed by Frank Marshall.
Oh, boy.
Prominently featured in it. He was a producer.
Yeah.
And there's Spielberg on the set and Toby Hooper, Craig T. Nelson, who you worked with and coach. And I was like, man, this is a good movie. Very little CGI.
That's right.
All effects.
Right. And scary.
Oh, incredible. When she's like, mommy, mommy. And she's in the TV.
Wow.
Every bit of it, it was gripping.
I gotta watch it again.
You'll see. And I watched it on television, but I remember, you know, that I'm going on and on and on. I'm getting looks. We gotta get out of here.
People have to eat.
I know. Yes. Tamara is going to tell everyone how to see your show.
I'm going to say some things. Look for Phil on his Netflix series, Somebody Feed Phil, and all his other stuff on Netflix, too. And you can follow him on Twitter at Phil Rosenthal. Thank you, Phil.
Bless you. Thank you. Love being here.
You can buy Ileana's book, I Blame Dennis Hopper.
Yes, you can.
Online and in bookstores. It's in paperback.
Yep.
Find us on Facebook. The website is ileanaspodcast.com.
She'll call to Tulsa.
We didn't even get to talk about that. Yeah, we didn't get to talk about the video with the president, but they can look that up.
I'll come back.
You come back and talk about that, because I love that, directing Clinton to be in your short film, which is great.
Yeah,
somebody. And you're like, so what? All right, everyone, as we end the show, as we always say, everyone's life is like a movie with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and this is the end of our show for today. Thank you so much. It's been such a thrill.
And then he died.
See you next time, everybody.
And we're out.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.